Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're going to dive right on into recapping all the week's security news with Adam Boileau, and then we'll head on into this week's sponsor interview with Casey Ellis, the CTO and co-founder of BugCrowd. As most of you are probably aware, BugCrowd announced its so-called next-generation penetration testing product last year, which was a move followed some months later by its competitor HackerOne. With others in the bounty space already offering these types of penetration testing packages, it looks like these efforts are here to stay. But where do crowdsourced penetration tests sit in the wider penetration testing market? Are they coming after the Insomnias and Atreides Partners types of firms, the NCCs, the shonky Nessascan penetration testers, those guys? Well, not surprisingly, Casey argues, this is a new sub-niche in the market, and he makes a pretty compelling case to support that statement, actually. And yeah, that's coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And funnily enough, Adam, our first story this week. A few weeks back, I was emceeing CrikeyCon, and there was a talk about container security. And I sort of made a gag that Docker Hub was like the Android app store for containers. And it turned out that was actually kind of bang on.
Yep, I can't say I'm surprised that this has happened. It turns out that Docker Hub got themselves breached. Someone appears to have nicked off with a bunch of records about users, including password hashes, which is not great, and integration keys used for tying Docker Hub to other platforms like GitHub. And they're saying it's like 5% of the user base, something like a couple hundred thousand users worth of data nicked over a short period of time. But the downstream impact of something like Docker Hub getting owned, right, is, you know, if you target it right, you use it right, could be really, really bad.
Now, you know, the advice normally would be to just enable 2FA on those accounts, but...
Yeah, apparently there's a ticket open. It's a feature request to add two-factor auth to Docker Hub from 2015. It's still open.
Yeah, so it was a listener who drew my attention to that one. Many, many thanks for that. So yeah, that's a bit of a mess. And look, I've been waiting for this one because... Yeah, I mean, you've got several problems with sites like Docker Hub. I mean, one is that this sort of thing can happen. But the other is you don't know who's uploading these generic containers into Docker Hub.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it promotes a supply chain that's pretty fast and loose with no real way of identifying, or without, you know, without a robust way of identifying the authors and, you know, who's responsible for any particular Docker container. And then, of course, if you're composing containers out of multiple other containers, then, yeah, like, you just have no good visibility and good way to control, you know, what your developers are pulling down and running. Yeah, of course, developers, you know, very used to this kind of low-friction workflow, and, you know, who knows what the supply chain looks like when you're just building it out of slimy, gross, low friction work.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because we've gone from code use to like full stack reuse of unknown provenance, and that's great.
Yeah, like it worked badly in the code time. It's working even worse now that it's whole system.
We got some interesting news here out of Slack. They are apparently going public, and they filed a bunch of documents with the SEC. And in those documents, they have really like warned investors that nation-state attacks against their infrastructure are things that they're not confident that they can mitigate, and that this could have a material impact on share price. This is very interesting. We haven't seen this before.
No, I mean, on the one hand, it's great that they're coming out and saying that they recognize it, that they recognize the importance of themselves as a target, and that, you know, it could have very real impact for them, and that they're actually expelling that out to their investors. Like, that's really great. On the other hand, the cynic in me is like, well, I guess they're just kind of, you know, preparing the battle space for when it inevitably happens or is already happening, and they're just trying to, you know.
Well, I did wonder about that, right? Like, what would prompt them to say this now? I don't know. Maybe they know something about that.
Well, exactly right. Because, I mean, you wouldn't want to be in a position where they had seen this kind of thing happening and then didn't mention it, I suppose. So there's a little bit of, you know, like, what does that mean that we're currently engaging in? But even overall, it is just good to see this being taken that seriously. And it's kind of a signal to other people who aren't, you know, listening, being owned by a nation state because they're in a supply chain of a bunch of other important things. You know, the fact that other people aren't doing that really is something that people should be paying attention to. Because if you're a, you know, if you're an Oracle or an RSA, or, you know, EMC, VMware, you know, anyone who's in, you know, Cisco, anyone who's in the supply chain for things that absolutely are targets, right, that's a thing you should have put in your, you know, in your guidance to investors.
Well, maybe that'll be the new norm. Let's see. Now, this next report, 2 weeks ago, we spoke on the show about the bug in Atlassian Confluence. You know, I even had a clip there from Shubham Shah talking about that bug because those guys were seeing it absolutely everywhere. And yeah, it turns out they weren't alone because someone has wormed it, apparently.
Yeah, if you're running Confluence on the internet, you're going to be having a bad time. There's a wormed couple of attackers kind of doing the rounds with worms, compromising both Windows and Unix installs of Confluence. One of them appears to be dropping some ransomware, which, you know, on your corp wiki might not be ideal. And there's another kind of DDoS bot, generic kind of Trojan being deployed on some of the Unix ones. So, yeah, if you haven't patched that, you probably will be very soon because you'll be rebuilding that box after you roll incident response.
Now we're going to talk about something similar but weird, which is people are exploiting a bug in Oracle WebLogic. Like, this is actually something happening as we speak. But it seems weird because they're like ransomwareing WebLogic boxes, which are middleware. So, like, they don't really hold any data that you care about. So you can just, like, reinstall and off you go again. It seems a weird way to make money, I got to say.
It does. Ransomwareing a WebLogic box doesn't seem super likely to have a great return on investment. But I mean, on the other hand, right, if you've got the bug, and let's face it, the bug is actually really straightforward. Like, I went and dug up a proof of concept because I do like me a middleware bug for different reasons, of course. And it's a great, wonderful, hilarious Oracle bug. But yeah, like, I guess if you knew you were going to lose the bug because it's getting publicized, it's getting patched, Oracle have released a patch for this particular one out of band, which kind of illustrates that it is pretty serious. Then maybe you make a couple of bitcoins. It's worth just spamming everything you can find with it and seeing what you get. But yeah, it does seem a bit dumb.
Seems a bit weak sauce, right? Like, that's you know, bad black hats. Come on. Do something with a bit more imagination. Even a Monero miner would be cooler than that. But anyway.
Yeah, or at least something that grabs the database creds that the WebLogic is using to talk to the backend or whatever other thing it's talking to. Walking up that, owning that, and then ransomwareing the database server. That's a better plan.
Yeah, there's a lot more you can do, right? So anyway, I'm so disappointed in you, criminals. I'm very disappointed. Norsk Hydro has put some numbers on its recent ransomware breach. We're looking at around $50
million. Yeah, he said $50 million. There's been a drop in production as a result of the, you know, factories being shut down whilst they dealt with it. You know, 50 mil is big money, of course, but compared to some of the numbers we've seen from, you know, the
Maersk and whatever,
Maersk and all that kind of thing. Like, these days, it seems like chump change, hardly even worth worrying about, even reporting on. So
yeah, well, they're insured as well, so they're probably going to see some of that back. But, you know, I've just found it fascinating, and I'm not alone in this, that Norsk Hydro has been so open about the whole experience, and they've sort of wound up creating an excellent case study here.
Yeah, no, it is nice seeing someone being open and also being, you know, kind of positive about their insurer, because we've seen a few cases, of course, where there's been some pushback from insurers about covering losses from the cybers.
Yeah. Now, this next story from Wired was written by Andy Greenberg, and it's an interesting one for me because some years ago I used to travel sort of semi-regularly. Every couple of years I used to go over to South Africa for a conference in Joburg there, which was a great excuse to get over there and, you know, do a bit of travel while I was in the region. And one thing that I realized is, you know, I think South Africa, the first time we saw SIM swap fraud, it was on a HR transaction, high value transaction, about $100,000. And that was in South Africa. So South Africans, as far as I can tell, were the first ones to figure out SIM swap fraud. Now, by the time I started traveling there, this was a problem that they'd largely got under control because the banks started working with the telcos so that if someone had SIM swapped a phone, they would know and they could kick up that transaction for extra, you know, authentication if it was over a certain level. So this is a problem that, you know, to a large degree, is under control in Africa. And Andy's written this story here just sort of wondering why on earth it's not under control in the United States. So I asked Andy to actually explain what the reactions were from the telcos when he asked them about this, because it would seem to solve a problem for both the banks and the telcos. Here's what he said.
None of them would really answer me straight. I eventually got sort of fobbed off to the CTIA, the Telecommunications Industry Trade Group in the U.S., and their answer was carriers do share some data, but they wouldn't tell me exactly what data. And it really seems like it's not the kind of comprehensive SIM swap real-time data that you would need to prevent these kinds of fraud attacks. And the reason for that, the CTIA told me, is because of first the scale in the US, which I believe it makes sense that there are a lot of bank transfers that happen in the US, and checking for a SIM swap every time would be pretty difficult. But then also, they claim that there would be privacy problems, that carriers can't share this data without consumers' consent, which might be true, but also seems a little bit like a shoddy excuse, because we know that carriers will share all sorts of user data if somebody just pays them. As we saw with, for instance, Joe Cox's story about the carrier selling your data to bounty hunters for just a few hundred dollars. So, you know, I don't know if that is a real answer. It seems mostly like African countries like Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Mozambique are actually just ahead of the US on this, probably because they've faced a lot of SIM swap attacks that were really serious because of their prevalence of mobile payments. And the US just has to catch up.
Now, I get where he's coming from on the scale issue, but surely that's a pretty easy nut to crack if you standardize the approach, right?
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is you'd have to have some agreement amongst the telcos of how to do this. Because, I mean, the data itself, you know, for making a fraud choice is pretty straightforward. I mean, really, as a bank, you want to know, you know, do either of the parties involved in this transaction have a SIM that's been, you know, moved around in the last week? You know, that's as good a metric as you need. It doesn't need to be more specific than that. You don't have to go down to the level of tracking, you know, IMEI hardware identifiers or anything like that. Just a, has it changed in a week? Increase the fraud score, send it off for manual review, no big deal. But getting the data out of the carriers in a way that's standardized, that all of the banks can use it. Because if you've only got a couple of banks, or you've got a, you know, banks that are more strongly controlled, telcos that are more strongly controlled and can be mandated to do these things, then, or they're motivated by the amount of fraud going on, then it's straightforward. But yeah, you could just see it being kind of a, you know, made into a much bigger deal in the US for really not a great reason, I don't think.
I can just imagine, though, most telcos in the US deciding to do this through some sort of bloated API that's, you know, going to wind up coughing up all user details to more bounty hunters sort of thing, right? Like, you can see that happening.
Yeah, you could certainly trust in telcos to overcomplicate things for no good reason.
Yeah, that's it. Now, Cloudflare, this is really, I got to say, quite heartening to see, but Cloudflare is copping an awful lot of heat at the moment. Of course, there was another white supremacist shooting in the United States targeting a synagogue, worshippers at a synagogue. It turned out the gunman had posted his manifesto to 8chan, a Cloudflare customer, and they're getting a lot of shit for it. Sleeping Giants, the organization that organizes media advertiser boycotts in the United States, they're onto it. And we've got this piece from Reuters here, which, funnily enough, actually cites Risky Business in it.
Yeah, it does. This one is talking about some of the investors in Cloudflare starting to ask questions. Obviously, you know, they want to cash out at some point in the future and are concerned about the value of their investment if Cloudflare becomes, you know, synonymous with internet hate speech, which...
It kind of already is, right?
It kind of is, right? And
I mean, we're talking about institutional investors. They're looking at a $3.5 billion IPO. I don't think they're going to want to torpedo that to keep 8chan on the internet. Like, I think Matthew Prince might find himself increasingly isolated on this one.
Well, yeah, I think so. And when the people who are paying, you know, look to get rich off your work are starting to ask questions, then, yeah, you have a much more real problem than, you know, a bunch of liberals on Twitter or whatever they've been writing off the criticism as so far.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Now, it's also been a bad week for our other favorite punching bag, Bloomberg. They published this story saying Vodafone found hidden backdoors in Huawei equipment in 2011 and 2012, you know, and it's this big thing where they had these secret backdoors and, you know, Vodafone Italy, you know, had to get them removed, and it was this big spooky thing. Turns out they were talking about like just a pretty garden variety fuck up on Huawei's part, which is like a debugger on Telnet or something like insane like that. That's not exactly a covert backdoor.
No, it really, the whole story just did not look good for Bloomberg. They made a real kind of mountain out of a very, very, very small molehill. I mean, show me any telco equipment that doesn't have, you know, a Telnet interface with a default CRED on it somewhere, which seems to be kind of what we're talking about here. Whether it was a debug interface or administrative interface, I was kind of a little bit lost on from the level of detail. But yeah,
we got the register reporting that it was a remote debug interface, but I don't know. It doesn't really matter, does it?
Well, no, it doesn't, unless you put it on the internet, I guess. In that case, it's a bad plan. And we have seen Huawei do that if you put it on the internet. But, you know, any telco that doesn't imagine that all of the gear they bought from all of their vendors, you know, mustn't be protected by, you know, lots of firewalling and segregation and kept the hell away from an untrusted network is going to have a terrible time. And obviously, we've seen plenty of people have terrible times for that reason. But, yeah, this is not what a backdoor looks like.
No, and we still haven't heard boo from Bloomberg about the Supermicro thing. As last time I checked, the reporters who wrote it have not run a single story since, right? Which tends to suggest that internally, maybe they've not been on the right side of this. But let's see. It's just Bloomberg just keeps printing utter rubbish when it comes to cybersecurity. So, now, okay, the weird story of the week. This guy, Joshua Schultz, who's the alleged Vault 7 source, has lodged a complaint. Now, this was originally spotted by Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel on Twitter, and CyberScoop then wrote it up. Jeff Stone wrote this up. He says he's been tortured, that the FBI are Nazis, that he's owed $50 billion because he could have become the next Bill Gates. And I think there was something in there about how his Second Amendment rights were being violated because he wasn't allowed to have a gun in prison.
Which, I mean, to be fair, he probably isn't allowed to have a gun in prison. But I don't know enough about American constitutional law.
So, now it's time to play the game, which is he mental or is he trolling?
I don't even know anymore. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe he has some legitimate complaints. I mean, I can't imagine that prison is a lot of fun. And it may well be that someone is being a dick to him, but $50 billion, really? Like, how are you supposed to make a credible complaint when you've got, rubbish like that in it?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it was handwritten as well. I spoke to Jeff Stone from CyberScoop, who wrote it up, and here's what he told us about that.
What's happening in this complaint is that Schultz is arguing there's no difference, essentially, between his pretrial detention and the incarceration that would come if he's ultimately convicted at trial. What makes this unique, and certainly what was surprising to me, was the way that he's trying to make this argument. It's a long, partially handwritten note, essentially saying he should be immediately freed because the government, by locking him up in the first place, has denied him the income, to the tune of tens of billions of dollars that he would have otherwise made through consulting and other kinds of services that are difficult to parse. Now, it's difficult to understand the strategy that's behind this, mostly because we're talking about an 80-something page screed against the government. At one point, he demands breaking up the FBI and goes on to compare them to Nazis, and some of the language actually gets pretty ugly. So it's hard to picture the judge, who has generally ruled in favor of the prosecution so far, read through this and suddenly decide that Schultz should be freed. But I also don't want to dismiss any of this outright. At one point, Schultz describes how his health has deteriorated and how he and now members of his family are suffering from depression and what sounds like some pretty serious anxiety. And we should keep in mind that he's writing this from the same jail in Manhattan where more than 1,000 inmates were stuck earlier this winter without heat or power because of electricity problems. So it's an unusual case, and I think it will continue to surprise people even before goes to trial in November.
Yes, well, I'm surprised. I think that's a fair assessment, right? I don't think he's going to have much luck, personally.
No, it doesn't sound like this is going to get a sympathetic reception, I'm sure.
No. Motherboard is reporting, this is a Joe Cox yarn, that a group of, persons unknown, let's just go with that, have hacked into a company called CityComp, which appears to be some sort of German data center or cloud hosting provider. They've owned the crap out of everyone who's a customer there, and they're ransoming the data, as in, we will dump it publicly unless you give us the crypto coins.
Yeah, they're claiming they've got something like half a terabyte of data from customers and from the company itself. And then apparently there's a bunch of fairly high-profile customers of this particular organization.
Yeah, Ericsson, Leica, Toshiba, UniCredit, British Telecom, Hugo Boss, NH Hotel Group, Oracle, Airbus, Porsche, Volkswagen. Like, it's a who's who.
Yeah, and so, I mean, if they're ransoming a bunch of juicy data from that, then, maybe this will have, I don't imagine they're going to get ransom money out of it, but, still, if they start dropping this stuff, and I think I did read something that said that they have published some of the information. I'm not sure if that's all of it or...
Yeah, that's not clear. It's interesting that you say that, because that's not clear from the write-up either. Like when I read it, I wasn't sure, because they're like, oh, they've made the files available for download, but they're ransoming the files. It's not really clear as written, is it?
No, it's not. And it may be like one of these things where the data is crypted and you can download it, but then you have to pay to get the keys or something like that.
Or maybe they've released some data to prove that they have the rest of it. I think that's more likely here.
Yeah, that's certainly maybe. I mean, that's the thing we've seen other ransom operations do as well, to try and coerce people into paying. But I guess it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, the Oracles and the Airbuses of this world are particularly happy with the situation, and there may be some pressure on the company to, you know, kind of make it all go away.
Shannon Vavra over at Cyberscoop has also written up this yarn. Cyberscoop is reporting that the NSA's Russian cyber threat task force, you know, which was supposed to be a temporary thing, is now permanent, and it looks like they're tooling up for the 2020 election. It's like, you know, Cyber Command is amassing its cyber hacking troops at the Eastern beachheads, at the Eastern routers, you know, cyber.
Very, very cyber. I mean, it does make sense that, you know, a permanent team of experts on how to turn off the Russian, you know, Internet Research Agency's tubes might be a thing that they're going to continue to need rather than just be temporary. Not super surprising in that. But, yeah, certainly they're, you know, everyone seems to be gearing up for the 2020 elections because, you know, we expect Russia to give it a go.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because this story sort of couches this as, like, this is something that's happening prior to an influx of resources. So this really is the 21st century, you know, online equivalent of moving troops around.
Yeah, it does read that way, doesn't it? I guess, yeah, we've militarized all our cybers and we can expect to see it, you know, kind of fitting with our military terminology.
Now, also by Shannon Vavra, we've got the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Robert Strayer, saying that these recent attacks and domain name hijackings, we're talking about things like Sea Turtle and DNS espionage. He's come out and said this is outside of norms, and they qualify as attacks on critical infrastructure. That's a big call.
Yeah, I think this is one of these things that, you know, it's on the surface of it just looks like a simple kind of conversation, but it is, you're right, it's quite a big deal to see. You know, because the development of norms around what's acceptable for people to do in the internet and in the cybers and what's not, you know, is still very much sort of, you know, a fairly young domain of international relations. And to come out and say, you know, DNS is critical infrastructure, it's, you know, important to the operation of the internet as a whole, don't mess with it because that's a violation of what we have agreed or what we want to agree are the norms of our relations in the internet.
I mean, I can understand why going after one of the root servers, which apparently did happen through all of this, I can understand how that could be considered an attack on critical infrastructure. I get that. But, you know, phishing someone for their registrar creds, not so much.
Well, yeah, but although some of these attacks were a little more interesting than that, about the ones that were involved with modifying DNSSEC. And then going into Packet Clearinghouse, and, you know, there was some complexities. I mean, I think you're right, the simple stuff of, like, let's just go hijack an individual subscriber account at a registry, you know, probably doesn't meet that threshold. But, you know, some of the more systemic, you know, ones that were, you know, did require more detailed tampering, and especially root servers, I think you could make a reasonable case for that.
Yeah, yeah. DHS has issued, this is interesting actually, it's a binding operational directive for federal government. CISA has now given agencies 15 days to fix critical vulnerabilities as opposed to 30 days that they had previously.
Yeah, I think that does make a difference. Obviously, the faster you can patch things, the better. But I think probably the important thing about, you know, making it that short is, you know, at 30 days, you can kind of do it manually. At 15, you really do have to have automated, you know, at least the asset management side of everything so that you know what you have to patch so that you can do it that quickly. Because, I mean, you know, doing it in a month, you can get away with it the slow way. So I think that's the... It feels to me like that's the knob being adjusted here, is to force more process, force more automation, force better management practice rather than just patch faster.
That's an interesting take, and it had not occurred to me. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Microsoft is apparently considering dropping its Windows password expiration policy, which, I don't know. I mean, it sounds, I don't know, rotating passwords, are they much good for anything these days?
Well, I'm certainly of the opinion that rotating passwords makes things actively worse. I mean, I have the data to assert that. I can't use that data, of course, in public to demonstrate it, because that data is from lots and lots of compromised Windows, you know, domain controllers over the years. But no, absolutely, rotating passwords.
Okay, you can't give us the data, but can you tell us how that data supports that conclusion?
So if you look at password changes over time, there is a direct correlation between the amount of entropy per password change and the number of times you change your password. If the longer you've been at an organization, the worse your password is because you're forced to change it more
And you sort
often.
Of run out of unique things that you can remember, right?
Well, you settle onto a scheme. If you only work somewhere for a month, it doesn't really matter. If you work somewhere for 10 years, you have to derive a scheme to deal with, you know, monthly or two-monthly or three-monthly password changes. And so the longer you've been there, the worse your password's going to be, the more predictable it's going to be. And, you know, you can, you know, I've got a script that ingests an Active Directory database, cracks it all out, and then generates per password change entropy data per user so that you can graph exactly those relationships over time. And so, yeah, in my opinion.
Why don't you write a report on this? I mean, that would be so much better than half the vendor shit that lands in my inbox every week, dude. Like, you would get global press for that. That's gold.
I don't know. I've got hacking to be done. Ain't no one got time to write white papers. Jeez. It's got to get shells.
Reckon this is a positive thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's you know, it was never a sensible control. I mean, the idea of password changing was to reduce the utility of a password compromised by an attacker in doing other things. And that was when we were sniffing passwords in the clear off the wire, you know, like Telnet or whatever. That's what it was designed around. And that's not the case anymore, where that's, you know, everything's crypted on the wire. You steal the passwords generally by stealing the password database or the hashes, and changing them doesn't matter because you should be using unique passwords everywhere. Anywhere with password safe, there should be two-factor auth. You know, those are controls that are useful rather than changing it regularly. And I would much rather, as Microsoft are proposing here, remove the requirement for changing it regularly, increase the length requirements, decrease the complexity requirements because those really don't add much, and let people not change their passwords ever.
And maybe roll out 2FA?
And maybe roll out 2FA, sure. And all sorts of other, you know, there's a bunch of other things you can do to make it not the user's fault, right, that they choose a bad password. Because there's always going to be users that choose a bad password. And you can help them with two-factor, with good monitoring, you know, with your logging in from, you know, Taiwan, where normally you log in from Sydney, what's going on. You know, there's a bunch of other stuff you can do.
Yeah, there is. But surely there's an argument that rotating passwords is useful in combating persistence, right? Like, so you can make previously popped accounts useless. But I guess, you know, as you pointed out, right, these days you're obtaining those sort of creds by reversing hashes. So you're going to have a lot of other creds to choose from. But that might be one reason to want people to rotate passwords.
So, I mean, rotating passwords has value when you're doing incident response and you do want to evict someone. But the problem, you know, before you go through the password reset process, you have to answer the question, well, where did they get the cred from? Because unless you're solving the root cause, which is that they got the cred from somewhere, then changing it doesn't matter because they can go get the new one or predict the new one in the case of a, you know, password that has a predictable scheme. And so, you know, we see a lot of organizations, like when we're doing red teams or something, and, you know, where we don't, where the process, once we've been discovered or once response is happening, is that we stand down, is that organizations don't then go and exercise the results of, oh, we would just change all the passwords to evict the attacker. It's like, well, actually, no, you don't know that that's going to work because you haven't exercised that. So there's absolutely value to changing it in response, but only in concert with all of the other things that you have to do around that to make it an effective response.
I can't believe you got through that whole thing without making any Kaminsky jokes.
I think everyone knows the Kaminsky joke. It's a great password scheme. We should all use it.
Sorry, Dan. moving on, and another one from Joe Cox here. There was this Microsoft Outlook email breach some time ago. Turns out the people who were behind this were after, you know, cryptocurrency creds, basically. So the people who were victims in that case, they lost their cryptocurrency. Sucks to be them.
Yeah, this is the one where Microsoft said that the attackers had only access to metadata, except in a very few cases. But this guy, one of the guys that was talked to by Motherboard, by Joe Cox.
Was this when they owned the support staff?
Yeah, this was the, you know, single factor Microsoft help desk or service agents or whatever on the back end of Microsoft systems one that we talked about. It was only recently. It was like 3 or 4 weeks ago now. But yeah, Joe Cox talked to one of the guys who had his cryptocurrency stolen through this scheme, and there was a forwarding rule added to his like Outlook.com account to snuff emails from a particular crypto exchange that he was using.
Yeah, it was like doing a keyword search on anything like with Kraken in it and then forwarding.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty weak. I mean, if you were describing access to create forwarding rules based on headers as, you know, metadata access. That's
yeah.
Pretty weaselly.
It is. But I mean, I got to say, like, if you're going to get into the cryptocurrency life, the Lambo life, you might want to use two-factor for this reason.
Well, I think that guy in particular, he lost one Bitcoin, you know, like $5,000. So he wasn't going to get no Lambo. It does appear that some other people did lose a little bit more. And yes, they definitely should have considered 2FA to protect the Lambo.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, your primary inbox, sometimes you can reset passwords. I don't know. Like it's, yeah. 2FA is only as strong as the reset procedures, right? For when you have lost your token.
Exactly, yes.
So that's something. A very unlucky Chinese developer has been jailed and fined for posting DJI's private keys on GitHub. Now, of course, this enabled people to pull apart DJI firmware and, you know, disable things like geofencing and whatever. Yep, off to the clink.
Yeah, this I don't think this guy really thought through this particularly well. He, amongst other things, like he posted some keys used to encrypt firmware. He also posted the private key for the DJI.com wildcard SSL certificate, which not well thought out at all. And yeah, he's been thrown into Chinese jail.
He says he did it by accident though. Like it's not like he's like, oh yeah, you know, free the geofencing and publishing him. He reckons it was an accident.
Well, I mean, in that case, yeah, it's a pretty unfortunate accident. If it's genuinely an accident, I do kind of feel bad for the guy. But on the other hand, I mean,
on the other hand, that sort of stupidity deserves a custodial sentence.
Okay, maybe listen maybe to when you. Put it like that, it doesn't. Maybe, yeah. Maybe DJI shouldn't have left their keys lying around where the sort of person who can post it by accident to GitHub would be able to post it by accident to GitHub.
Okay, we got a skateboarding dog this week that is really not related to cybersecurity, but I could not resist. The spy whale.
Norwegian fisherman ran across a white whale.
A beluga whale. Very pretty, very intelligent creatures.
Very smart and apparently quite trainable, because this particular beluga whale was wearing a harness with a GoPro adapter. And then when the fisherman attempted to communicate with this rather friendly beluga whale, who appeared to be after some fish and was quite happy hanging out with humans, they removed the harness and it had, property of St. Petersburg or something written on it.
Equipment of St. Petersburg, yeah.
Yeah. So they phoned the, marine, you know, mammal research people at the university or wherever in St. Petersburg, who said it wasn't us, it was probably the Navy. They're kind of into that sort of thing, so, mm-hmm.
So, less sharks with frickin' laser beams on their frickin' heads, more beluga whales with frickin' GoPro cameras on their frickin' torso. Well, they don't have torsos, do they? But you know what I mean, on their bodies.
On their bodies, yes. Russian-trained spy belugas in the Norwegian waters doing who knows what. Russians, of course, have had a history of, you know, training marine mammals to do, you know, minesweeping and helping divers and all sorts of crazy things. Ours was also reporting apparently they trained them to be like living torpedoes where they would like carry mines and swim up the ships and then blow them.
Oh
up,
man, like if you want to look at the military use of animals, there's an older bloke who lives around here who always tells stories that like 90% of the time he's just talking completely out of his hat. And he told me once about pigeon guided missiles. And I'm like, this is typical, right? Like this is just horseshit. I Googled it and yeah, there were in fact pigeon guided missiles. They trained pigeons to like tap, you know, the image of the ship and they'd get a reward. And then they started mounting them in the cones of these things. I think the thing was disbanded in the end, but bat bombs as well. Yeah, Google, that's Jesus. Bat bombs and pigeon guided missiles. Very interesting stuff. And, well, you know, GoPro beluga whale seems pretty benign in comparison to those things. But anyway.
Humans really are the worst species, aren't we?
We do suck. We do suck. But so did the Nazis. So, you know, if it takes a few pigeons to get rid of them, I'm okay with that. Now, look, we just got a reading recommendation this week. FireEye they've been running what they're calling Carbonac Week, because, of course, they got their hands on the Carbonac source code. And, you know, they're running it with, like, shark graphics and stuff. So it's like Shark Week, but Carbonac Week. And they've run, like, a four-part series on it. And a lot of it's pretty interesting, actually.
Yeah, this week's update, apparently the Carbonac crew wrote their own like video system for the screen recording function in the Carbonac Trojan. So they had a scheme where they would kind of watch what people were doing in the financial environment that they compromised, so they could learn what, you know, the pattern of life was, how the transactions worked, how the back-end systems worked, and all that kind of thing as part of the recon, which is, you know, absolutely a thing that you have to do when you're working in quite specific business environments like finance or wherever else. Anyway, they had their own scheme for recording the screens down and they have their own playback system. FireWire have reverse engineered or kind of built a player out of the parts that they've got, and then were able to use that to look at some screen capture videos that they found lying around as well. And one of them was at least one of the operators of Carbonac kind of getting his things together before going and owning someone. And yeah, they got some good screenshots of the operator in question preparing to go about his hacking business.
Fin 7 were pretty amazing, man. They even had a front company called Combi Security and would like try to recruit red teamers and stuff to like, you know, oh, it's a red team, you know, like that sort of stuff, right? Just incredible. So go check that out. Now, look, before we go, we're going to talk about the drama.
InfoSec Twitter dramas.
InfoSec Twitter drama, which we normally leave them alone, but I've just had many listeners ask me to comment on this one. For those of you who mercifully like did not encounter this, yeah, blessedly, that's right. For those of you blissfully unaware of what happened, basically Brian Krebs jumped into a Twitter thread to dox a couple of people. One of them is a gentleman who goes by the pseudonym of Vincent Canfield, and the other one is, of course, a Twitter user who goes by the handle of NotDan. And it the whole thing was just super weird. It really looked like Brian was just jumping in to flex. The thread happened to be about a video put together by Canfield with assistance from NotDan, which in it they were trying to prove that Spamhouse blocks people for port scanning, like adds IPs to block lists when they get a SYN scan. So they were trying to prove that you could like spoof IPs to their honeypots and get those IPs blacklisted. I've got no idea if that's the case. You know, Spamhouse say it isn't. These guys say it is. But it doesn't really matter because I suspect, and here's the thing, right? I suspect that this doxing had absolutely nothing to do with Spamhouse and SYN packets. I think there's some other conflict going on here that we haven't seen, and I don't think Brian should be doxing people on Twitter. Just full stop.
Yeah, I mean, Brian's a great reporter and he has a great vehicle for delivering his work with, you know, all the necessary context and story. And, you know, he's at his best when he lays out the full story end to end and all of its great details with all of the doxing and good stuff, you know, in the format that we're kind of used to consuming from him, you know, rather than, you know, lowering himself to Twitter dramas.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it was unprofessional and has just made him look bad, right? Like, there's just no question about that. If there is some bigger conflict here, you know, I mean, at least give people some indication of why you're doing what you're doing. I mean, I will say that the Canfield fellow operates a mail service called cock.li. I believe he also hosts the mail infrastructure for 8chan and runs a anonymous VPS service where people swap Bitcoin for VPS services. So, you know, this is the sort of person that you can imagine coming into conflict with someone like Brian Krebs, to put it mildly, right? And I don't know, maybe NotDan was collateral damage in all of that, or maybe he's all up in that stuff as well. But the thing is, the fact that we're speculating, the fact that we don't know means that Brian shouldn't have done it, right?
Yeah, like that's the real takeaway, yeah.
That is the real takeaway. You don't just go around doxing people in Twitter threads. Now, I like Brian. Brian's a great reporter, right? You know, he makes mistakes. I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. I think this was one of them.
Yeah, and I think it's much, you know, it's not the right format because you don't get enough context and all of the backstory that explains the how and why. And I think it must be, you know, when you're Brian and you're sitting on a whole bunch of, you know, half-finished work, sometimes it must be tempting to, you know, to go flip the middle finger at someone who's being a dick on Twitter, you know, with that information, which, you know, maybe you've got reasonable confidence and maybe you don't.
But these guys didn't appear to be doing anything to Brian, right? Like, that's what makes the whole thing so weird. And that's the only reason I think that there's something more to this is because he just sort of popped up randomly in this thread, like, hey, here's your LinkedIn. You know what I mean? Like, it was just like, damn, what the hell is this all about? There's got to be more to it.
Just got visited by the Krebs fairy in the middle of your thread for no reason.
Boom, docs. Docs for you. Docs for you. Everybody gets docs. And yeah, anyway, it didn't go down well. A lot of people giving Brian a lot of shit over that, but it's totally deserved. All right, come on.
Yeah, and I'm sure he will, you know, think about it and then go back to doing what he's, you know, what he is well known for doing, which is good quality investigation and research and docs and things.
Yeah, well, let's just leave that one there. I think we've spoken enough about that. Adam, that is it for this week's news. It's been a pleasure, my friend, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. So, up next, it is time for this week's sponsor interview with Casey Ellis. Casey is a co-founder of BugCrowd, where he now serves as CTO. As I mentioned at the top of the show, late last year, BugCrowd announced it was launching a penetration testing service. The idea being that you could pull together a group of testers from their bug bounty talent pool who'd be paid for their effort instead of just being paid for bugs. And that means those participants can work through some pen test methodologies and get paid even if they don't find something, and the client gets to say, hey, these methodologies were applied against these apps, which is actually, you know, often what pen test buyers are looking for. Now, in terms of connecting resources to work, this actually does seem like quite a good idea, but it doesn't mean that companies like BugCrowd are aiming to dominate the pen test market or even to displace most of the current incumbents. There's plenty of room for everyone, Casey says, with the exception of the shonks who seem to be popping up everywhere offering genuinely awful services that they're calling penetration tests, just due to the scarcity of skills in this area. And yeah, those air quote pen tests don't really fit the traditional definition. Here's Casey with some thoughts on how we wound up in this situation.
No one really knows what the word pen test means at this point. Everyone's using it, but there's not a lot of agreement on what it actually means. And I think, you know, the traditional definition of pen testing that I grew up with and that people like Atreides and Insomnia follow, that model, like that kind of went out the window at scale. I frankly blame the definition that the PCI Council came out with in 2007 when they distinguished a pen test from a bone scan and said that a pen test is a bone scan with human verification. Like at that point, you know, this whole idea of it being like adversarial simulation and you know, objective driven and all that stuff, it got held onto by those companies that, you know, you and I would talk about today as like they're the good ones, and kind of, you know, capitalized by some of the bigger organizations that have come in and basically figured out a way to profit off all this.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you've got this situation where what you and I think of as a pen test and what people, you know, most people in our circles think of as a pen test, that's not necessarily what the wider market thinks a pen
exactly.
test
yeah,
is,
yeah.
right? And
yeah.
I've had those conversations like with people who work at, you know, there's even a couple of tech startups close to where I live, and you know, you meet people who work there, small town, right? And mm-hmm. they're like, yep. Yeah, we got a pen test, they did XYZ, and you're thinking, that's not a pen test guy.
Yeah, no, for sure. And this is the thing that is interesting in terms of, you know, just kind of how you framed up what we've done and the timeline of it all. You know, what we did at the end of last year was released NGPT, which was really an iteration of our approach to applying crowdsourcing to the pen testing market in terms of what the market calls a pen test, right? We were doing that right from the get-go. And one of the early experiences with BugCrowd was frankly pissing a whole bunch of pen testers off when I talked about this as a way to get the same output according to the market's definition of what a pen test was.
Well, and I remember you and I doing interviews years ago where you came forward, and it was kind of bold at the time. You came forward and said, look, if you do one of our bug bounties, for all intents and purposes, that ticks the box for PCI.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. So, and you know, that's been true for a long time. But then what we did with NGPT, as I just said, is, you know, the challenge with it is the amount of hours that you get out of it, the diversity of the skill sets, and ultimately the results that you can then go off and reduce risk with are higher because of the model. But if you put that in front of an auditor, you're going to spend the next week and a half explaining what the hell crowdsourcing is. And you know, no one wants to do that, right? So the whole idea is like, how do we fulfill the typical business requirements behind a pen test, as well as getting the results of a distributed like resourcing model? But then also start to speak to things like assurance. You know, it's a funny one because I've always kind of bucked at this idea because, it's just not possible to prove a negative. I think assurance in terms of how it's interpreted by the business is a little bit overblown. Just because you tried to find something and failed doesn't mean it's not there. But at the same time, you have to be able to explain to people what you've tried. And that's not something that's easy out of the existing bug bounty model. So.
Yeah, so this is a lot about actually having some demonstrated, workflow.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what did you try to do? Like, how do we, as, you know, a CISO who's talking to a CFO who doesn't understand what the hell any of what you and I just said is, because that's not their job. Like, how do you basically get past that particular conversation and move forward? So, you know, it's really feeding into that. And then, you know, kind of back to this definition thing, it's sort of a manifestation of that, right? Because it's, you know, you talk about the the good pen test teams, quote unquote, like the folks that that really take pride in their work and do an excellent job, you know, what we're doing more of these days is actually partnering with those folks, because oftentimes in terms of the level of trust they're given or the kind of, you know, engagement, like these are not people that are coming in, answering a question and then getting paid and going away. These are folks that are engaged to work with a company over the next 12 months to like go after root cause and do defensive architecture, all that fun stuff. Like crowdsourcing's not ideally suited to that. So that's the kind of thing where, you know, if we can do the discovery and they're doing more of that, there's actually an opportunity for us to all make peace and work together quite nicely. And that's starting to happen, which is cool.
Yeah, well, I'd imagine for some consultants coming into a job, they're like, okay, you know, here are the high risk places with, you know, decent attack surface. We're going to target these. But just for a bit of peace of mind, we should probably throw the crowd at like, you know, these five things over here, right? So I can understand as a broader program, like for expediency, it would make a lot of sense. One area where you're looking to go into though, and I think this is a really interesting idea, is being able to match people with requirements for testers with to people with really sort of esoteric skill sets. And this is something that I know is a problem. Like, I can't really go into too much detail about the specifics of this one, but I have been talking to someone who I know who's looking for a tester to do a product test for something really specific that not a lot of people know a lot about, right? And and they're having trouble. So I can really see how if you all of a sudden can list, you know, a whole bunch of testers who know a lot about some of these more esoteric things, that, yeah, I mean, there's going to be demand there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's often, you know, what we're finding people looking for and what we're actually able to deliver against when it comes to NGPT in terms of how it's like really taken off as a product over the past coming up on 6 months or more. It's actually that use case. Because I think, you know,
sorry to cut you off there, but can you give us an example of the types of skills that you're talking about?
Yeah, so if you, I mean, a fun one is, you know, IoT, right? So you say, okay, cool, this person's an IoT tester. They're really good at IoT. So like, what does that mean? It's almost like saying, okay, this is a rock song, which is great. It's a good starting point, but you don't really know much else about the song until you've dug a bit deeper. So, you know, typically what happens and by volume, the greatest number of researchers that are out there, you know, folks that understand embedded systems, they understand Linux, they understand, you know, PHP or whatever front ends are operating on top of a consumer IoT device. It's like x86 or ARM or whatever else. It's basically the garden variety stuff that lots of people have access to and lots of people have skills on, right? So that's cool. But then, you know, what if you've built on RTOS or what if you've built on, you know, custom silicon? At that point, the fact that someone's conversant with the idea of physical device testing, like that's a good starting point, but you're not sure whether or not they've got the specific things that you need them to have as context to do the right kind of testing for your particular product. So that's an example. That's one that we're bumping into. We've bumped into that in the auto industry for a while now, but it's been popping up more in other parts of, you know, embedded system testing for probably the past 6 months.
And how do you go about actually recruiting the talent to fulfill those types of tasks, right? Because do you actively recruit them or do they just sort of, or is, you know, the bug crowd a bit of a magnet that just sort of draws those people in?
Yeah, I mean, we start by being a bit of a magnet. I think this has always been the strategy, you know, run public programs that have no real barrier to entry other than just to be able to find a bug and demonstrate skill. And then use that to get the initial idea of what someone's good at. And we've got a fair few IoT programs out there that are a magnet for testers and also validate whether or not they can do this stuff. So that's the starting point. But I think, you know, downstream of that, Jason Haddix, who reports to me in here, like phenomenal researcher himself, but also a phenomenal advocate and educator. His team put a lot of work into recruitment kind of through education. So it's basically, let's teach people, you know, the next set of things they want to learn in this space, but in, you know, the kind of attraction of people to that content, we get an understanding of what people are interested in. And at that point we can validate it as well.
Now, one thing that's been pretty funny is, of course, you know, your competing firms, we'll call them, have also announced that they're, have also announced that they're moving in this direction, which, you know, I mean, you can view it as competition or you can view it as validation. That's up to you. Yeah. But it's funny that, you know, some people are jokingly referring to this move by the bug bounty industry towards these, you know, so-called next generation pen tests is transitioning them to being like Uber, but for pen testing. Which is a piss take, right? Like they're having a laugh, but at the same time, like it's not really the worst description, is it?
Yeah, no, it's a funny one because you know Uber for X is a bit of a you know standing joke now.
But it almost actually fits in this instance, right?
Yeah, but well, where I was going with that is the reason it exists and the reason it became a standing joke is that it was actually a pretty good way of saying yes, I'm going to build a marketplace to connect a thing with a different thing. So, you know, yeah, it's a piss take, but it's also not a bad way of talking about it. You know, Uber and them as a business aside, like I think the idea of, you know, when I started Bug Crowd, it wasn't actually about bug bounty or vuln disclosure as much as it was about the idea of this being the future of work in a lot of different areas. And the fact that the adoption of bug bounty by Google and Facebook at the time kind of signaled that security was next. It's like, okay, our scarcity of resource, the nature of our problem, like the difficulty we're having in getting this stuff done is actually forcing us into thinking about it in different ways. And that was the catalyst for you know, frankly, going back to the founding story, me actually starting the company in the first place. And then, you know, bug bounty and BDP obviously are standalone, valuable and important things, and believe in them 110%. But in context of this conversation, they're more of a catalyst than they are a definition of what we do.
Casey Ellis, thank you very much for joining us on the show to chat about all of that. It's really interesting, mate. Best of luck with it.
Appreciate it.
That was Casey Ellis of Bug Crowd there with a chat about what is a pen test even? And yeah, I can absolutely see where these types of rapid-fire tests are going to be useful. Let's just see how they go with this. It's interesting stuff. You can head on over to bugcrowd.com to check out their next generation penetration testing services or their old school bug bounty programs. And that is it for this week's show. I will be back tomorrow with part two of our first Snake Oilers edition for 2019. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.